Hello and welcome to another episode of History Lesson Part 2. I am Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
And today, the movie we will be talking about is 2015's Trumbo, directed by Jay Roach, written by John McNamara, and starring quite the large ensemble cast, actually, but I'll try to remember them all. Bryan Cranston, Diane Lane, Louis C.K., which we'll have to talk about, Helen Mirren, John Goodman, Stephen Root, and Elle Fanning, and Michael Stuhlbarg, all in pretty meaty roles. But before we talk too much about the movie, we're going to do this one kind of similarly to the way we did our last episode on Megan. Obviously, with the ongoing WGA strike, I wanted to do an episode about AI, but then I also wanted to do an episode that's perhaps a bit closer to home about the Hollywood blacklist. And I spared Tyler from having to watch about, I guess, three or four other movies that try to tackle this subject matter. So I will be giving a brief dispatch on all of those before we get into the meat of it. But before all of that, Tyler, we're going to do some real History Lesson Part 2 shit here. And let you talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts, the nitty gritty of the subject matter here today. So I guess what I will start off with is I do think the Hollywood blacklist is actually like a fairly well-known thing for what it was and for being the kind of thing that you'd think everyone would be trying to brush under the rug like over and over again throughout history. I actually think it is something that people do kind of at least know about, but what do for any listeners who aren't aware or maybe need like some brushing up, what are the things to know about the Hollywood blacklist and maybe the Red Scare more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic premise here is in the early 20th century, like starting in the late 1800s and into the early 1900s, you have a pretty dramatic rise in popularity of the left, because work sucks and capitalism is hard. And the left says, hey, doesn't your job suck? And isn't being poor shitty? And people say yes. And that's, you know, the growth of the left comes out of that moment, and it's pretty dramatic. And then you have in quick succession a series of historical calamities that really sort of break people's faith in capitalism. And those are the First World War, which, though it's been, retrofitted to be some sort of fight for freedom, even at the time, it was very, very obvious that the First World War was just a clash between European empires squabbling over who would get to conquer most of Africa and the rest of the world. It had nothing to do with none of there were barely any democracies involved in any real sense.
Even in the First World War thought that it was a fight for free, like,
exactly.
It wasn't even really the empires involved didn't even really try to pass it off as that.
Exactly.
Like, exactly. It was pretty
nakedly.
They
talked about it as being,
we need the more stuff. Come fight so we can have more stuff.
Yeah, and for the glory of the king and the glory of the empire and so on. And so soldiers came back communists. They came back socialists. They came back trade unionists. They came back hating their government.
Particularly the ones in Russia. You might say.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. Yeah. And Germany. The First World War ends. People don't know this. People forget this because it's all been like totally. This is like the First World War has been really rewritten for us. What people forget is that the war ended with revolution, not just in Russia, but actually in Germany. So the Russian Revolution happens in 1917. Russia pulls out of the war and you know, the battle lines shift, but the war continues. And then in 1918, German workers rise up against their monarchy and overthrow it. And again, it's a socialist communist revolution in Germany. Now, it gets crushed pretty quickly, and so it doesn't survive the way that the Russian Revolution does. That's partly why it's forgotten. But, it sets off, obviously, a cavalcade of important historical shit that happens in Germany at that period of time. There's a revolution in Hungary. There's a revolution in Ireland. There's a revolution. There's almost a revolution in Spain. I mean, Europe is consumed by revolution after the First World War because of how shitty it was. Now, that doesn't quite translate in North America. You don't have revolutionary movements that succeed here in the same way. And that's complicated historical reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with the settler composition of the white working classes in North America. But even still, you have a dramatic rise in left agitation and angry working people in the West. The Winnipeg General Strike is 1919. It's an obvious example for us here. All of this is to say, there's this growing discontent and a rise in the popularity of the communist parties. Then you have the Great Depression, which comes straight out of the First World War almost immediately. I mean, there's a brief sort of interlude where there's a lot of finance capital flying around in the 1920s, but that's brief and it doesn't really spread to the bottom. Most people experience the 20s as bad, and then the 30s as insanely, horrifically, absurdly bad. So capitalism yes. is just completely in crisis. And it's in that context that people start en masse joining the Communist Party. Certainly in Europe, that's happening. It's happening in Spain. It's happening in Italy. But even in North America. And then, of course, there is the Second World War. As if things hadn't been bad enough, you then have the rise of fascism, which is a explicitly anti-communist ideology and rises specifically out of a reaction to the rise of the left. So, okay, all of that is to say, this is a world historical moment where ideology is really, really polarized. The left has grown dramatically. There's been a right-wing reaction to it. There have been two world wars, a Great Depression. And all of that meant that a lot of people had been interested in the left and had joined communist and socialist parties. After the Second World War ends and the Cold War sets in, the United States government becomes really deeply paranoid and suspicious about the possibility of socialist agitators within the United States. And that is the context for the creation of the House Un-American Activities Committee, famously, would ultimately be led by Senator Joe McCarthy, and these trials in Congress or in the House Committee. Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? This kind of thing.
That classic line.
Classic line that's actually burned pretty deep, I think, into popular consciousness because it was a really crazy thing. It was a really intense, crazy thing. McCarthy was like, even in his time, McCarthy would be viewed the way we viewed someone like Alex Jones. He seemed like a nut. He seemed like he was really unhinged and over the top. And a lot of people, and I do think the movie did a decent job of that element of this. When this stuff starts, when these kind of, witch trials of communists or former communists or supposed communists, when it starts, people think of it as being really wacky. And again, the way we view a lot of far right stuff right now. It then does take on a life of its own and it expands and it becomes pretty serious in a lot of ways. And one of the many groups of people that got targeted were writers in Hollywood, some of whom had flirted with a link to the left and had joined communist and socialist parties, few of whom had any really deep roots among the left and certainly none that I'm aware of that had any actual concrete connection to even the CPUSA in any sure. deep sort of way, but certainly not the Soviet Union. I mean, the idea that they were, planting seeds of communist ideology on behalf of the Soviet is just ludicrous. The Soviet Union had no interest in even doing things like that. But that's the way that it got framed. And so the movie obviously, it focuses on specifically 10 people, 10 writers in Hollywood who were called before the committee and refused to, fess up and name names. Most people or a lot of people that went in front of this committee would just sort of sheepishly say, yes, you know, I did join the Communist Party. I was young and stupid and I made a mistake and now I'm a true American and believe in freedom. But, you know, these 10 guys in Hollywood didn't, in part because they felt they were somewhat arrogantly confident that they'd be able to win and that, that they would, you know, this would go to the Supreme Court, they would win and they would embarrass, you know, these lunks at the House Un-American Activities Committee. So there was a certain amount of arrogance there. And then it turned out they didn't win. And so they got blacklisted. No one in Hollywood would hire them to do anything, to do any work. And so they had to write under false names and, you know, they lost their incomes. You know, of all of the people targeted in the Red Scare of that era, the Hollywood 10 are probably the 10 people I'm least worried about in the big picture. You know, the Red Scare was used to destroy the trade unions, to attack people within the state who had even liberal positions on things. Like it was used to go after the civil rights. It was then called the freedom movement. Like there's lots of ways in which this stuff was mobilized. The fear of communism, obviously, against the actual communists and socialists that existed. You know, and I'm much more sympathetic to those other people, the Hollywood 10.
Yeah, the Hollywood 10 are just the sexiest. Like, from a sort of like from an American culture, just in terms of what has like sizzle in the mind of the average person. I think the reason why the Hollywood 10 are what people know about the Red Scare or what people remember about it has a lot to do with it's not the thing that I necessarily gravitate towards, but like the big entry point for a lot of people into getting like mad about this or getting like or being disgusted by it is the freedom of speech angle, which is like there were literally 10 people who were basically told like you can't fucking write anymore, you can't work in Hollywood anymore because of things that you've said, essentially because of your membership in a political party or whatever. And so that I think really, like, especially from a Hollywood perspective, we were talking about this off mic, but it's actually kind of surprising that there aren't more movies about this because of how much Hollywood likes to make movies about movies. It's like literally a movie about sort of vicariously through a couple of sort of almost like front organizations, like the hammer of big government coming down and censoring Hollywood. And that is like, that has a lot of sizzle for a movie, you would think. And for, I think, a lot of people who maybe don't care about the Red Scare that much or don't like, they don't have they're not maybe necessarily very politically sophisticated or they don't consider themselves on the left. This is kind of an easy thing for them to metabolize as just being like, oh, that's kind of fucked up that like these people weren't allowed to like, and especially because in America, like what is the ultimate like punishment? It's like, you can't create content. You know what I mean? So
your podcast is
exactly, you are right. Shut down. You are correct that like ultimately these are not like the greatest victims of the Red Scare by any means, but they are maybe the most relatable in some way or like emblematic even.
Well, and I think to a certain degree. I think the other thing about this, and this is part of why I think part of the reason I think there aren't more movies about this is, and I will, when we talk about the movie Trumbo, I'll get into this. I think the movie struggles because you can't criticize an anti-communist thing in a liberal way. It's not satisfying. Mm-hmm. It's an unsatisfying movie in so many respects because liberals agree with anti-communism. And a liberal movie about a Red Scare wants to say, and this is kind of what the film essentially gets at, and it's a contradictory, confused film in part because of this, the film wants to say the tragedy here is that these guys were not actually communists. They were persecuted and oppressed as communists when they weren't in fact communists.
Right.
For me watching the film, I'm like, yeah, that's why I don't really give a shit about these guys. Like, let's talk about all of the communists who were targeted. You know, the film accidentally almost justifies the premise of the Red Scare by saying, like, oh, if they'd been communists, it would be fine, but they weren't really communists, and that's the tragedy. Like, it's a very complicated thing to cover, to sort of tell a story about an anti-communist Red Scare if you're not going to side with communism, right? Like, you're walking a strange tightrope if you do that, and that's what this film tries to do, and I think that's partly why.
I don't actually completely agree, and I think it has a lot to do with, as I said, the other movies that I did not force you to watch out of a sense of like guilt, largely.
Yeah,
because I do think this one is you're not wrong, because I think it does essentially have a liberal point of view, but it's not a noxious one to me personally. But we'll discuss that. Maybe.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I'm sure the other ones are worse, and I appreciate you taking one for the team.
Yeah.
It would have been tough
on me.
We'll
get to that in due time.
I will say this. I'll say one more thing about, and then I can turn it over to you to take on those other things. But one other thing I'll say about the Red Scare and Red Scares in general, because there's been many of them, and in a certain sense, we're sort of edging our way into another one now. But the thing about the Red Scare, it's genius, is that what happens is, being a communist, being on the left, becomes this bad, bad thing. And it's framed as this bad, bad thing. So much so that it starts to be like, there's no discussion really about whether being a communist is bad. We all know being a communist is bad. It's just a question of, are you or are you not a communist? And so you have two choices. You can either, you know, basically you can either be like a communist and then therefore you're a bad guy, or you can deny that you're a communist and therefore you're a sniveling liberal who has no principles. You're stuck. If you do, in fact, you know, if you are in fact on the left, you're really put in a tricky position. The very existence of a Red Scare delegitimizes being on the left. And I think, I mean, I will give the film some credit in some ways, like probably much more so than the other ones you watched. Like, they did try to get at some of that. And, you know, they did kind of try to point out the way in which once these things start, like, if you're accused of being a communist in the context of a Red Scare, you're in a weird position because, yeah, your choices are to either deny it and sell out some of your principles, you know, even if you're only kind of a leftist, denying it and being like, no, 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 I never, you know, well, you certainly aren't a socialist now. And, you know, and I'll link this to a guy. This will be the last thing I say before I let you take it on with the other movies. But there's a guy, a Canadian guy, actually, that I want to bring up who was caught in the Red Scare, because it happened here too. Sorry, everyone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But all the same shit happened here. And there was a guy named Herbert Norman who was a... Do you remember this guy? Yeah. So he was a principled liberal. He was a principled social democrat. He was not a socialist. At no point was he a socialist. But he was a guy who, you know, was a left liberal and meant it and took it seriously and was sincere about it, which almost inevitably means that you end up siding with socialists very often. Because if you're being honest, and the context for this guy was that he was in Asia at this exact time in the post World War II era, he was watching the Korean War and he was advising the Canadian government about the situation in Japan after the war, the situation in China, and the situation in Korea. And he kept advising the Canadian government not to do really bad things it was doing. For instance, the Canadian government was part of a process that allowed pretty much the entire Japanese fascist leadership to go free and face consequences for what they did, including the emperor. And Herbert Norman sends cables back to Ottawa and says, this is a really horrible idea. You have no idea. This guy you just set free was literally nicknamed the monster. And
yeah, these are war criminals, literally. Like,
these are the worst kinds of war criminals. Yeah. And you're losing respect for allowing these people to be set free. Now, this guy's not a socialist for saying that. He's a liberal, and he's saying, hey, come on, we're better than this. We can do better. Come on here, guys. But he got swept up in the Red Scare because he was being critical from a left liberal perspective. He was being critical of the Canadian state. He gets swept up in the Red Scare. He's accused of communism. The CIA and the FBI investigate him. He ultimately ends up committing suicide. He jumps from a building.
You cover this in the book, don't you?
I do, yeah, because I think...
That's why I knew it from somewhere.
It's a pretty crazy story. And, you know, this guy was not a socialist. He really wasn't. You know, if anything, like, that's his main fault, is that everything should have pointed him to the fact that socialists were right, including the very fact that the Canadian state was hounding him to his death for being critical. Like, that should have made him a socialist. It didn't. And yet he was hounded for, you know, supposedly being a socialist to the point where he commits suicide. To me, that captures the Red Scare. And, you know, so the Hollywood 10 maybe don't, the story isn't as dramatic and it doesn't have the high stakes as that, but that's what a Red Scare is about. And in that sense, I mean, I like that the film tries to get at it, and it's a shame there aren't more films about it. But I do think, as I said before, the reason is because Hollywood doesn't want to tell that story properly, and it's a hard story to half-ass.
Well, in many ways it can't.
Yeah.
You know, this movie, We were talking about the budget before we started recording for different reasons that you can check out my other show if you want to know why. I'll just say that much. You know, this movie cost $10 million. $10 million is a drop in the bucket for a fucking movie. It's not very much. I mean, these days, something like this might get relegated to at Netflix or something and get $1.5 million or something. So it's not nothing, but like $10 million is just, it's not a large budget for a movie. It's hardly anything at all. And yet it was $10 million for a movie about an avowed communist who was blacklisted. And you can, you know, argue about the way it approaches the material or whatever, but like, that's what the movie is. And it could only get a $10 million budget. Can you imagine how much gets shaved off that budget from every investor the more aggressively the movie pursues?
Yeah, for sure.
Those questions, like, it, you know, so that's another thing, is that I am probably, when we get into talking about like our opinions of the movie a little bit more, like, I'm probably part of the reason I'm more lenient than yourself is because I'm just kind of impressed it got made at all, even the way that it got made. Because Hollywood is so constitutionally and institutionally unable to make movies that are explicitly anti-Red Scare, basically.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It reminds me of, and I'll let you, I'll just quick thing, but it reminds me of the Canadian, I think, I'm pretty sure it was a Canadian, pretty sure it was like a NFB made, you can fact check me on this, but the movie about Norman Bethune, starring Donald Sutherland as the titular Norman Bethune, which, you know, on the one hand, it's like, oh, this is so fucking cool. And the very fact that Norman Bethune was a avowed communist in the same era, especially in the 20s and 30s, he actually goes to Spain and fights in the Spanish Civil War. He went to China and fought against Japanese fascism in China. He was a genuine communist.
And probably on balance too, the most famous Canadian of all time.
Yeah.
Just not in places that we think of.
Exactly. But, he's in his Chinese school textbooks. He is part of the Chinese school curriculum. He was hugely respected for being a true internationalist, a doctor who went and materially helped anti-fascist, communist, you know, revolutionary movements. He's a pretty cool dude. So the film covers that, and by default, it portrays some pretty dope shit. You know, like, there's some pretty cool stuff in that film, because there's just no way to tell the Norman Bethune story without telling some of these cool things, you know? And yet, at every turn, in every possible way, the film tries to undermine his legitimacy, casts various aspersions about him in different ways. Oh, he was mean to people. He was demeaning to, he was a womanizer, sure. All of these things, which, I think actually we should do that. We should do an episode on that movie. I have so much to say
about it. We should do that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But anyways, it just reminds me of that in the way that this movie tries to get at something and deserves credit for that, but in my opinion still falls kind of short.
Yeah, and that's totally reasonable. And just before I get into the other movies, which will transition very, very nicely, I think, into our discussion of this movie, I wanted to ask about just a couple of figures as a prelude here. If you don't know that much about them, that's totally fine, but I was just curious if you knew anything interesting or felt like there was anything interesting to say about, well, there's three people in particular that are portrayed in this movie who I think are interesting to talk about, or there may be some interesting kind of things that people don't know about them. And those are obviously the titular character or person, Dalton Trumbo. sounds like Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
Writing a obvious Donald Trump stand-in.
And the movie came out in 2016, so like
or 2015, but yeah, okay, it's right, funny. Yeah. It's funny that like people like I was, my wife walked in like halfway through and watched the end of this movie with me, and she was like, "What's his name?" And I was like, "Dalton Trumbo." And she was like, "Yeah." I kept wanting to say Donald Trumbo, and I was like, "That can't be right. That's way too close to." Anyways, but yeah, Dalton Trumbo being one, Hedda Hopper being the other, and then of course the third being John Wayne. I was wondering if you had anything interesting to say about any of those three people, because they figure very heavily in this movie in different ways.
Yeah, not really. I mean, nothing about Hedda Hopper. I didn't know about
who she was. Yeah, I didn't know who she was either. I had to look her up.
Trumbo, I mean, I think, Trumbo is pretty insignificant in terms of like the history of the left in the USA. Like, he's not as significant at all. The film takes shots at him for being a champagne socialist.
Sure.
And it's not wrong. We'll come back to it, but it's not wrong. He was certainly there's even hardly in his writing. And I scanned through and tried to find out as much as I could about his actual, the actual screenplays that he wrote. And there's really not much left content to them. There really isn't. So no, not much about him.
I mean, it sort of varies. Like because I would say it's Johnny Got His Gun. That was his book that he wrote that won the awards, I believe is what it was called. Like, that's a left anti-war novel. And it was kind of what made his, it was a big part of what made him as an author, as a writer. And I agree with you, like, particularly his movies that he wrote aren't particularly, I think some of that sneaks in for sure in certain places. Like, I mean, Spartacus, you could see there's like some, vaguely left-wing ideas in there for sure. They're kind of less specific because of what the movie's about. But I mentioned this just to say, like, it's not like it was totally absent from his writing. It's just a lot. It's just reasonably absent, or surprisingly absent maybe, from his writing for the fact that he was like literally blacklisted for being a member of CPUSA.
That's the thing. I mean, that's for me the point is, like, for a guy who, was treated as though he were some kind of radical. I mean, the characters at various points, there are moments where the characters in the film laugh at the idea that they would be seen as radicals. And they are right to laugh, because it is ludicrous. The liberal case for these guys aren't communists, they shouldn't, like, it holds up. Like, they should, by the standards of a Red Scare, like, they really were not people that the United States needed to be worried about. So, yeah, not much on Trumbo. The only thing I'll say about John Wayne that I think is interesting to add here is, so John Wayne, obviously, was this, like, you know, gun-toting reactionary. Interesting, too, I should note that Ronald Reagan is briefly in the film in real footage, you know, testifying about the communists in Hollywood. And John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, I think, you know, there's a lot of similarities there, except that John Wayne was the better actor. But
Significantly.
Yeah, by a large.
Yeah, John Wayne actually talented.
Yeah.
is the difference there.
That is. But the thing I wanted to say about John Wayne is just that because John Wayne figures so heavily in the Western canon, like Western films, which were super reactionary and racist and bad in a lot of ways. What I think is interesting is that just today I actually watched a film ghostwritten by a blacklisted Hollywood writer, which was a Western.
Now, see, I actually looked into this.
Okay.
I looked into this, and very recently it has been amended to make this guy the sole writer of Broken Arrow.
Oh, interesting.
So he wrote, and that's the movie that you're talking about. I'm sorry to blow that reveal for you, but there was very recently a sort of like a Dalton Trumbo with Roman Holiday kind of situation where they finally did just, it came out and it's been amended in the literature about the movie that it was written by, I can't remember the guy's name. Do you remember? It's all right. That's fine. Well, I want to do a little mini series on Westerns at some point. So this movie will probably come up again.
Yeah, it should actually, because it's really interesting. It's from, I think, 1950. And I'm pretty sure it's one of the first Westerns to meaningfully portray the indigenous people in the film in a positive way. Now, that's not to say that there aren't things that are really uncomfortable.
It's from
now.
The 50s. It's going to have some stuff that's not. Yeah.
Like there's a lot of things, but you know, for all of its superficial flaws and things that would be done differently now, and rightly so, at its core, it's like, it's pretty anti-colonial. It's pretty anti-settler. It's pretty anti-American. There is no equivocating that the Apache are in the right. 100% in this film. That's pretty cool. That was written by a blacklisted Hollywood writer, and that stands in such incredibly sharp contrast to the John Wayne schlock that was being pumped out. So, you know, for me, that is a kind of an interesting little tie-in on John Wayne. But other than that, not much to add on the historical figures. I didn't even know Arlen Herd, who the film portrays as kind of like the most legitimately socialist of the 10. I'd never heard of him.
Well, there's a reason why you've never heard of him. He's a composite character.
He is a
composite of, and one of the guys that he is a composite of is the guy who wrote Broken Arrow, whose name I don't remember.
Okay.
He's a composite of, I believe, like Clifford Odets, the guy who wrote Broken Arrow. There's one guy, he's a member of the Hollywood 10. I'm going to actually just like very, cause I want to get his name in there, cause he's actually a very noticeable or notable guy. And I just can't remember his name, so I'm just going to very quickly pull it up. I will find it. Alva Bessie. That's his name.
Okay.
That's the guy that it's mainly based on, as well as Samuel Ornitz and Albert Maltz, who was the gentleman who wrote Broken Arrow. So I wanted to get that out there because Alva Bessie – in particular is an interesting guy, and he was Jewish. He was an avowed communist. He never recanted his beliefs, and he suffered for it. Like he never worked again, basically.
Right.
And
right.
there's a moment in the movie where the character Arlen Herd mentions fighting in the Spanish Civil War, which Alva Bessie did do. So he's the one that is like the closest analog to Arlen Herd, but basically I don't hate this decision. What they sort of did is they, rather than having a bunch of guys kind of fight for screen time, they took the three or four most ideologically committed members of the Hollywood 10 and amalgamated them into this one guy who, you know, it's not Bessie who died of lung cancer and who had his wife leave him. Bessie lived a long time. But like most of the sort of ideological stuff comes from Bessie. And then there's a couple of other details that are woven in. They're mostly, from what I gather, all things that did actually happen. They just didn't all happen to the same guy. They just kind of took from a few different members of the Hollywood 10. But yeah, I did want to get that those guys' names correct, because they're sort of the most interesting and the most worth like looking into if you want to do your own research, folks.
Yeah. But that's actually good. I'm actually glad to hear that, because I was sort of perplexed that I didn't know about this Arlen Heard figure, and fair. I was like, yeah, it's really strange. Yeah. Like, can't find any film. Yeah, so that makes sense.
It makes more sense when you know that, because I had the same, especially because Arlen Heard does 1,000% sound like a real guy who would have been. Like,
oh, totally. Like, just 100%. Yeah, I totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like it sounds like Arlo Guthrie, or you know, like, yeah, someone who would be in the Matawan, you know, like,
yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So, just before we get into the meat of this movie, I do want to discuss some of the other movies that have been made about the Hollywood Blacklist. The first thing I did when I decided we were going to do this episode, this was the movie I had in mind, but I was like, I don't know, Tyler, maybe you know a better one. Like, it seems like something you would know about, like anything good on the Hollywood Blacklist. And you were like, I don't know shit. I've never even really seen anything about it. And so I just went to Wikipedia, and they have this little, I literally think there's like 13 movies on the list. And it's this little, like, it's not even a Wikipedia article. It's like a, one of those like specialized searches that's like, you know, Wikipedia sections, movies, sections, Hollywood Blacklist or whatever. And I just went through, and as far as movies that are actually tangibly about the Hollywood Blacklist that aren't documentaries, there's really only like four or five. So I didn't bother watching like The Majestic, because I read the plot of the movie and I was like, this is stupid horse shit. It has almost nothing to do with it. Same thing with like The Way We Were is probably like the most famous movie that tangentially deals with the Hollywood Blacklist, but it's also, it wasn't like super well received by critics. And it, once again, it's kind of tangential. So I was just like, I'm not bothering with that. The other three that I watched, and I may actually have to revise my, what I said about the most famous, because I actually think there's one, which is one of the three that I watched that might be the most famous, but the three are, in chronological order, The Front, starring Woody Allen, unfortunately, Guilty by Suspicion, starring Robert De Niro, and then, of course, Good Night and Good Luck, directed by and starring George Clooney and David Strathairn, who appeared in Matawan.
Matawan, yeah.
And I want to very, very briefly touch on these movies, because I think they contrast with Trumbo in a very interesting way. So in some ways, The Front and Guilty by Suspicion are kind of the same movie as Trumbo in a way, because they are essentially, and they're, then the, these two movies next to each other, like they're very similar, like, they're extremely similar in how they're structured. Trumbo's at least structured a little bit differently, but they are really just movies about Guilty by Suspicion in particular is like a wheel the TV into the classroom. Here's what the Hollywood Blacklist was like kind of movie, and about how it was bad. And it was, you know, the hearings were bad and freedom of speech and yada, yada, yada. And that's kind of like what both of the movies are about in different ways. The Front is kind of interesting because it is directed and produced and stars many people who were actually blacklisted. And that made me really interested in watching it. And it made me really want to like it. But it's mostly a comedy. And while it's definitely saying that the Blacklist was bad, and it definitely like wrings some pathos out of the Blacklist, and there are, it does portray to a certain extent, like, there's one guy in the movie who commits suicide because he's blacklisted. And so, like, that, you know, that's in there and that's good. But it's just kind of wussy, you know? Like, it's very limp-dicked for the fact that it is made by all these people who were actually blacklisted and actually had like a tangible effect on their lives. But it's the more interesting of the two because it's sort of centered around basically the movie is about rather than being centered around like a Trumbo guy who is blacklisted, it's centered more around kind of like I believe is it Ian McClellan Hunter was the Ian McClellan Hunter was the guy who was the front for Roman Holiday, except that in this instance it's a made-up guy and all of the characters are made up. Some of them are loose analogs for real blacklisted people from Hollywood, but it's centered around this this guy played by Woody Allen who is pretending that he is the writer of all this stuff but is actually just like a cashier who's picking up like a little bit of extra Skrilla and signing his name on stuff that's written by these like really great like blacklisted writers or whatever. And it's very like George Costanza. And I mean, we don't have time to get into like Woody Allen, obviously, you know, one of those guys who if half the shit about him is true, he's a bad guy, you know? So
yeah,
not like a guy that I really want to spend an hour and a half with in a movie, but it is also like a uniquely kind of good role for him in a way, because it's like this guy who's full of shit, who doesn't really have a lot of, doesn't really have strong convictions, just looking for a little bit of money. And then he's like, he's dating this woman who thinks that he's like written this amazing like thing about like workers' rights or whatever. And he's just like, he's just like, I wrote a script, but anyways, how about the Mets, you know, like shit like that or whatever. And it's amusing. It has its moments. It's not like terrible or anything, but like I said, it's just very like cucked. Like it's really just not, doesn't have anything to say really for a movie made by actual blacklisted people. And then
it is an interesting just before you go on to Guilty by Suspicion, there's an interesting parallel there where like it's Woody Allen in the role that you're meant to sympathize, sort of sympathize. And you know, in Trumbo that we just watched, it's Louis C.K. who plays the Arlen Heard character, the composite character of the most solid members of the Hollywood 10. And so he's given a lot of pretty good lines. And in some ways he's the anchor, the sort of moral conscience of the film more than Trumbo is. And yet he's played by Louis C.K. And I mean, he's just unwatchable to me.
Sure.
Louis C.K. now is maybe even more so than Woody Allen. I personally find Louis C.K. just makes me feel ill, and to see him doing his Louis C.K. thing,
entirely
which
reasonable.
He does, he leans into just being Louis C.K. It just, it sucks. And that's not the film's fault necessarily. Yeah. I mean,
no,
you
it's
know,
not.
Who knows? Who knows what they knew and what they didn't know? But yeah,
totally. Yeah. Yeah. Like I don't have a complicated take on Louis C.K. the guy, but I do have a complicated take on his performance in this movie. And so we will return to that in a moment, but you're right. It is interesting that like two of the kind of like, certainly like most famous, comedic Hollywood sex pests both happen to be in these like movies about the Hollywood blacklist is sort of unfortunate. Moving on to Guilty by Suspicion. Guilty by Suspicion is kind of the same movie, like where it sort of opens with like, oh, the blacklist is happening. Look at all these people who are getting fucked over by it. And that also ends in the same way as the front, with like a testimony where the people doing where HUAC is basically like dressed down by somebody they're lectured. It's a big movie that leads up to somebody lecturing. Yeah. But the difference is that the front is like at least trying to be like funny and kind of like pithy and interesting. The Guilty by Suspicion is just a very like kind of paint by numbers, like historical, like pseudo. It's not a biopic because none of the people in either of these movies are real people, which is also very annoying. But it does have like a couple of touches in it that I liked. The best part of the movie, hands down, is that Marty Scorsese is in it acting. really? He plays a director, and he's the best part of the movie. Like, his performance is great. He's doing the very like quick talking, like, you know, like, if you've ever seen Marty Scorsese act in a movie, he doesn't do it that much, but he does have, like, he could have been a character actor. He's pretty good. He does one thing quite well, and it's to be this kind of like quick talking, like, manic energy, sort of like clever, maybe has a screw loose kind of guy. And in this movie, I'm glad I watched it just for this scene, but there's a scene where he's talking about, like, I'm going to go to Europe. I'm just going to go to Europe. And they're like, you can't go to Europe. Like, you can't let them do that to you. And he's like, why? I'm a communist. I was a communist 20 years ago, and I'm a communist now. and it was just like that alone. I was like, okay, I'm glad I watched this movie just for that scene. And I do give a credit. Like, I give that movie credit, and it's only a hair of credit for at least portraying like one guy positively who is like, I'm a communist, and is doesn't feel bad about it. But again, all of these people are fake. They're made up, like, no real people in them. And that could be interesting if it was done in a way that was like, we're doing this so that we can wash our hands of the real people involved and the maybe like problematic elements of them, and try to actually portray like an ideologically committed Hollywood group of people who were blacklisted. But of course it doesn't do that. It does the opposite,
right?
Which makes it very similar to the movie that I'm about to talk about very briefly, hopefully, is that the movie is about the liberals who were caught up in the Red Scare. And it's really portrayed that like those guys were the real like victims of the Red Scare, which makes it, for me, of these three sort of like explicitly Hollywood blacklisty movies that are about HUAC and are about, like, you know, yada yada yada, Guilty by Suspicion is the worst one for me, because it's the most cloyingly like liberal and sort of the most offensive, in that it really does sort of make it seem like the people who were the biggest victims were, you know, the principled liberals who didn't want to name names because they thought the whole thing was wrong, but of course weren't communists, like, would never dream of such a thing. And that brings us to the third movie, which I think, looking back, for a modern audience anyways, is probably the best known movie to sort of tackle this subject matter, which is Good Night and Good Luck.
Which I've seen. I just looked it up. And I've seen it. I watched it. It obviously had almost a net zero effect on me because I didn't even remember that I'd watched it, but I have seen
it. Yeah. So I saw this movie when I was a kid, and I was like, you know, I was old enough, like, I think I would have been like 12 or whatever, but I was old enough that the subject matter interested me. This has always interested me as a subject matter, or as a subject, like, both for movies, but also just like in history or whatever. I actually, you'll get a kick out of this. My grade 12 history essay, our history class was basically centered around like World War II onward American history, which is like the stuff you don't really learn as much about in Canada, in social studies or whatever. And I had to do an essay, and it was like, I had to make an argument or whatever. Like, I had to argue for something. And two things that we had learned about were like Stalin and the Great Purge and the Red Scare. These were two things that were covered actually in close succession to one another in the class, because the era overlaps quite a bit. And so the essay that I wrote, and like, okay, remember, I was like 17 or whatever, but I also look back on it, and I'm like, you know what? Like, pat on the head for a little 17-year-old Jackson for figuring this out, even if I would rewrite it completely differently now. The essay that I wrote was essentially being like, you know, the Great Purge, the what they call like show trials and et cetera, and the Red Scare. And just being like, here's one thing, here's another thing. How can you like look at these two things and say, as an American, that you have like the moral authority to point at someone else and say like, oh, it's bad that they do this, when like at the same time, America was doing the same thing, basically.
Good instinct, man. Good instinct.
I look back on it and I'm like, you know what? That's pretty good. Cause I was not like, I was just a like logic dork, like lib really at the time.
Yeah.
But
no, that's pretty good. That's great, man. That's impressive. Look, if I were to pull out the stuff that I wrote at that time, it's bad news. In fact, there's an essay that I keep. I still have it. I still have the printed version. It got like a B+ or maybe even an A, because I'm pretty sure it was my first year of university and the prof was probably a fucking neoliberal. And I wrote this essay about how Marxism is out of date. And it was just the shittiest piece of shit essay. It was filled with fucking cliches and, you know, Marxism can't, I said, Marx is an old dog. Marxism is an old dog and old dogs can't learn new tricks, the new tricks of the modern economy, and Marxism just can't keep up. Like, it is a fucking turd, man. It is the biggest fucking turd. Enough. And I just keep it because like, it's good for me to remember.
Yeah, fair enough. This is one of those things, though, where I do feel like my instinct towards contrarianism, in right. at least when it comes to certain things, like definitely probably helped me out in some ways. Yeah, because I mean, on the one hand, I was the kid who sat in the back of history and social studies and went, hey, this communism thing doesn't sound so bad, for sure. But like, I was also just like, I would always just be like, I still believe this. This hasn't changed. Like, I would always just be like, look, man, you can believe whatever you want. That's not like, they can't put you in jail for what you think. That's not like, that's not fair. Like, that's not how it works. You have to actually, at the very least, you have to actually do something to have to face consequences for being a shithead or whatever, right? And so like when I learned about the Red Scare, it pissed me off even as like a young kid or whatever, because I was a nerd. I was a deeply nerdy kid, especially when I was like a young kid. And so I saw this movie, and it was like in the Oscar bait, you know, tier of movies or whatever, and it was nominated. Yeah. And it was my dad's a movie buff, and my grandpa was a movie buff. He was still alive at the time, and like, so you know, movies were always a topic of conversation, and this was one that we all kind of wanted to see because it was interesting. And my grandpa, it was a socialist. Like, he was he campaigned for Tommy Douglas, and like he was, you know, as he got older, he sort of would have read like more as just like a staunch like liberal or whatever, but that had a lot more to do, I think, with what political options were available to him than like what his actual convictions were. Like, he went to union meetings for the entirety of his working life. He told me when I was like 8 years old that Jesus was a communist, like all this kind of, you know, shit or whatever. So he was interested in it. My dad was interested in it. I went and saw this movie, and I was like, that was the most boring fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. I would have been like 12. And so I rewatched it again, like a week ago or whatever, going like, okay, well, let's see what I think now. Like, I'm an adult. Maybe it'll be different. And I watched it and I was like, this is the most boring fucking thing I've seen in my life. I was right when I was 12. Yeah. And it is literally nauseating to watch now. When it came out at the time, we were not where we are politically now. It was a Bush era movie, and this is the fucking problem, is that you see it now with movies where you take it can be done well. You can take a movie and make it portray a certain era, but really it's about now. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the obvious example is like, I've never seen the movie and I never really watched the TV show, but like MASH is about Korea, but it's actually about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And you can make that work in a certain sense, but in this movie has aged so just shit because it is just deeply boring. And the entire fucking movie is just like, Edward R. Murrow owns Joseph McCarthy with facts and logic. Yeah. And it's just the most debate club fucking, like, there's a part where Joseph McCarthy is, and it's the real Joseph McCarthy, which is an interesting touch or whatever, that they just use archival footage of him or whatever. But like, he's talking about Edward R. Murrow, and he's like, I have proof that Edward R. Murrow was in the Industrial Workers of the World and like did this and went to the Soviet Union or whatever. And I'm like, ah, this guy sounds cool. Like, what's the deal or whatever? And then Edward R. Murrow's just immediately denies it and is like, but, you know, we must defend the right to be wrong or whatever. Yeah. And it's like, God fucking damn, I hate this shit. Like, it was boring. It was stupid. And like, I like Clooney. You know, I like George Clooney. Sure. I don't have a problem with George Clooney, but like, man, just not, it was real bad. It was the best made of the movies, but just the worst, most boring fucking movie as a movie, and just stupid. I hate the fucking logic dork thing.
Yeah. And this is the thing, you know, when we get to it, that the problem with Trumbo, the problem with the movie is that you can't tackle the problem of anti-communism through liberalism. You can't do that properly. What you end up with is just the most stale, boring, like you say, debate society. I will defend to the death your right to speak it. Bullshit. Just void of.
Yeah.
Because, you know, anti-communism, if it serves a useful purpose, it is that it like forces us to lay our cards down at a certain level. And to say, no, you know what? I am a communist and this is why. And I stand by it. So, you know, you're not going to get me with this like game of like, will he admit that he is in the evil club? Fuck that. The club isn't evil. Like, there's nothing evil about wanting people to have a baseline of equality, wanting society to be organized for the greater good and for what makes sense rather than for the profits of the rich. These are all reasonable things. You can't do that if you're a liberal.
So that brings me to why I like this movie, kind of, or at least like I like it way more than all of the other ones that I watched, because it contrasts with them in a very like shining, shimmering way when it is placed next to these other turds. and that is that it, first of all, it is about real people and it centers those real people as the subjects of the story. So this movie is about a guy who was a communist, got blacklisted, went to jail, and then tried to continue his career. Like, you can argue it subtextually or the way that it's presented or whatever. It certainly doesn't, like, it sands the edges off of him being a communist for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't have a scene where he says, like, oh, well, I was just mixed up. Or, like, I was just... His attitude throughout the movie is the attitude of Martin Scorsese in Guilty by Suspicion. There's a scene at the beginning of the movie where someone asks him or whatever. Like, anytime that it's presented to him, he is always like, well, I am a communist. So, like, what do you want from me? So I like that element of it. It's important to me to draw a distinction between this movie and these other movies, because it is about a real guy and the real guy is presented as being a communist and as that being like an integral thing to why this happened and an integral part of him. And he is portrayed sympathetically. Now, you can argue that he's like, he could have been portrayed more sympathetically or whatever. And it certainly does like sand off some of the edges, and it could be a lot more explicit about his ideology or whatever. But, you know, if we're going to criticize this movie for not being something, I think it's also important to point out things that it could have been that it is not, or ways that it could have been worse. And because I saw so many of the ways that it could have been worse, I have to give it some credit in a couple of places. That is one. Like, I think a nice like point of contrast is I have the opening crawl from this movie and then the opening crawl from Good Night and Good Luck. I'm going to read the two of them, and I think you'll see where I'm coming from here. So this is the opening crawl of Trumbo. During the 1930s, in response to the Great Depression and the rise of fascism, thousands of Americans joined the Communist Party of the United States. After the U.S. allied with the Soviet Union during World War II, many more joined the CPUSA. Screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, a longtime champion of workers' rights, became a member of the party in 1943, but the Cold War cast a new light of suspicion on American communists. So that's pretty Cliff Notes version of the story.
Yeah.
But I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
All of that is like factually correct.
Yeah.
It's not trying to present the information in anything other than, I would say, like the, to the extent that there's editorializing, it is, I think, trying to just in very short order explain to the audience for this movie, who are, I would imagine, like people who are interested in the subject or interested in movies about movies or who are liberals. It's just trying to offer a very shorthand, quick explanation of like, oh, this guy's a communist. Why is he a communist? And it's like, well,
yeah.
If nothing else, even like the least charitable reading of it is, well, it was a reasonable thing to be at the time.
Yeah.
Which is better than, oh, well, he wasn't actually a communist, or like,
yeah,
you know, making up a thing where he renounces his communism or something, which is like 1,000% a thing that could have been written into this movie and would have been like, would have completely tanked it from the very beginning. So anyways, that's the opening crawl for this movie. This is the opening crawl for Good Night and Good Luck. Throughout the 1940s and 1950s, America was overwhelmed with concerns about the threat of communism. Senator Joseph McCarthy made a public accusation that more than 200 card-carrying communists had infiltrated the United States government. Few in the press were willing to stand up against McCarthy for fear they too would be targeted. I fucking hate everything about that.
It's weaker for sure. It's definitely a lot weaker.
And once again, like a lot of this is just in deciding to center the movie around a real guy and just dealing with the consequences of that. And then also making the guy that it's centered around be a guy who actually paid the price for what he believed. Now, not the same price that other people paid, but a guy who did go to jail, who did get blacklisted, who wasn't able to work under his own name in the industry, is at least, if nothing else, this movie does make the point that the biggest victims of the Hollywood blacklist were the Hollywood communists that were not able to write because of the blacklist.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to make the case that the real victims or the biggest victims were the people who were caught up in it.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And I know, and we'll get, I know we're going to talk about Edward G. Robinson, and we're going to get to that because that is a problematic element of this movie. But if nothing else, the movie is at least about this particular guy paying the price for this. And it's very unequivocating in this was bad because it was bad, and not it was bad because these people got caught up in the middle of it, or, well, it would have been fine if they were all real communists or whatever. It is just very much like, this is a fucked up thing that happened.
But yeah. See, I quibble though. Like, I think right. You're right in comparison maybe to those other really, really bad versions of it.
Egregious ones. Sure.
Yeah. And so I get where you're coming from when you're watching them against those other ones. Having not watched the other ones, watching this in isolation, it still does that. It maybe doesn't do it as bad, like, but from the very start of it to the last speech that Trumbo gives when he's
which
old,
is and the
right?
ending is. I did not like the ending.
Okay,
so I will concede to that,
because that's, you know, basically it ends on the note of like, you know, we went through all this shit and we didn't even do anything. Like it really. I think it sounds like Good Night and Good Luck was like watching CNN. And so
it really like, was. Yeah. Exactly.
So like I sympathize, like anything compared to that would seem a lot better. I'm going to still hang on to, I think, some of the things where I take issue with this film. I mean, I'm giving it a C. I don't think it's the worst thing I've ever watched.
Sure.
And there are bits where I give it credit. But there's also, like, for me, the film was just so contradictory. It was pulled in so many different contradictory directions. So where Good Night and Good Luck might have just been, like, ostentatiously liberal, this wasn't. This
really
had
is.
Moments, right? I mean, look, the Arlen Herd character, the composite of the real socialists, I would argue that he is supposed to be the moral center of this film. In which
I would
case,
agree.
Right? Okay, so in which case, the film then is basically saying that the best guy here is the socialist. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I can get down with that. However, at no point in the film do we really get any serious sense, besides like a couple throwaway lines from Louis C.K. about the Spanish Civil War, mm-hmm. of the content of their politics, of why any of it matters.
Yeah.
And that's something
that is reasonable.
You know, like that's something that liberals do about communists all the mm-hmm. time. Liberals, because they don't have any real principles. They don't have any meaningful principles. They don't know how to portray. They don't know how to show us a character who's a socialist in a meaningful, concrete way, because they don't know that things matter to us and they don't know what things matter.
Yeah.
So the certainly. Best they can do, and again, you know, it tries, but the best mm-hmm. they can do is to, yeah, Louis C.K. has a throwaway line about the Spanish Civil War. There's some stuff about Louis C.K. being broke.
He does have a little argument with Trumbo at the beginning. That's probably, it's one of the most interesting parts of the movie or exchanges in the movie, where he says, like, he's talking about how he's like, you make me uncomfortable. Like, being on this ranch with you makes me uncomfortable. I can't trust you mm-hmm. because you talk like a radical,
mm-hmm.
but you live like a rich guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that sequence is interesting because I actually like, that's kind of one of my favorite. I wish there was more of that because that felt very lived in.
Yeah.
It felt very real, like the kind of discussions that people would have with one another, because neither one of them is entirely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
CK's argument seems more familiar to me because I relate to him more because I don't have a ranch, but I'm actually like, I actually do in essence agree with everything that Trumbo says, which is just basically like I have this money or whatever and I can live nicely. So like what I owe it to the movement to like live in a shithole to like prove my socialist bona fides.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, I'm not going to like, I don't believe in martyring myself mm-hmm. for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of it's almost like the argument that you'll hear like socialists make about athletes
mm-hmm.
In some ways, where you want workers to be in a better position, and part of being in a better position is being able to buy a house, being able to have these things. And so while it is definitely like a good thing to look on people with a certain amount of wealth suspiciously, it's not like Dalton Trumbo owns a restaurant or owns this or that or the other. He's a guy who made money being a writer who just happened to be very successful at it and buy, you know, like,
yeah.
A very nice property to live on or whatever.
And
it's a good little scene. I like
yeah,
it
is a
good
scene. Yeah. I mean, it's all of those scenes are ruined for me because of Louis C.K. delivering.
Yeah, we'll
and
get back
also,
to that in a second.
And I also think he doesn't do a good job of it. I also think he fucking sucked as an actor in
Fair
it.
Fair enough.
I don't know if that's – I can't tell if that's me reading back, you know, into it, knowing what I know or what I would have thought without mm-hmm. knowing what I know. But yeah. I mean, I did not think that he was good in that role, but I also, I liked that scene. There were a couple of others where they kind of have these arguments. And I said this about another section that we should talk about, which is when mm-hmm. Trumbo's in jail. We can get back to that. But the scenes in when Trumbo's in jail, the scenes with Louis C.K. where they're sort of debating about, you know, who's the real socialist and what does it mean to own a ranch and whatever, all those things. These would be scenes that would be really, really cool in the hands of a socialist director.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. I said to you, like Ken Loach, like I would love to have Ken Loach sure. be unpacking this, because in some ways it would be the same thing. It would be the same dialogue. It would all be anchored in the various threads and the various real existing tendencies within the left and the fights that happen when you're part of the left. And yeah, like sometimes there's a rich guy. I knew a rich guy, you know, who had a cottage. And I remember, you know, we joked because this guy would have a big, like, you know, get together at his parents' cottage in fucking, sure. I don't remember it's not the Hamptons, but you know, and it was like, oh yes, the socialist retreat to the Hamptons. And you know, but so does that mean that the guy can't participate in the trade union movement? No, not, No, it doesn't. I mean, you know.
No, so and the, honestly, sometimes those guys are awesome.
Oh, you need them.
Because
yeah.
it's like. Yeah. Well, yeah, because like it's like they feel guilt.
Yeah.
And so you could really like. Totally. You can get them. You can shave off some of that fucking. Like, you know, petty bourgeois skrilla for yourself a little bit. Or that's, for, you know, they're very reliable sources of income.
That's
you know?
Why everyone so went to his cottage, right? Thing. Yeah, no one felt exactly, bad about going to his cottage. But so that's the thing. Like, okay, if these kinds of fights between people of the left and around what it means to be on the left, what is your individual relationship to wealth if you are part of a collective struggle for justice? That's interesting stuff. And I would love to see it portrayed. The problem is this film was so detached from anything meaningfully socialist at its heart that it just felt like these kinds of throwaway bits of just ephemera that were given, you know, the same amount of weight as the absolutely fucking bizarre minor plot detail that that Diane Lane punches a speed bag periodically.
I mean, what the fuck? Yeah,
So
that the stuff with his family is
it's a bit weak.
We'll talk about
but it's given equal weight, and that's my problem. It's given it's the debate with Arlen Heard is treated as this kind of like side note thing, character development thing, when in fact like stuff like that should have been at the heart of it. We never got a sense for Trumbo. We never got any sense of why he would. Why would he take such huge risks on the on the premise of his principles? We got no sense of it. We only ever saw one scene where he argued with someone from a studio about a strike for state. I think it was stagehands or set designers.
They try. You know, like they do try.
Yeah,
they
give it that.
They show him. Yeah, like they show him being active in the stagehand strike. And there is like, there's a, I'll just admit right now, like it's cheesy as fuck, but it worked on me a little bit. Like I had a little like, kind of like, that's cute sort of moment when he's talking to his daughter, and it's at the beginning of the movie.
And she asks him,
it's really good. Like it's the closest thing that. And it is it's a little corny, and this movie is corny. It's deeply cornball, but like there's a good, it's the closest thing you get to a sense of who this guy is. And he's talking to his daughter and she goes,
Dad, are you a communist?
I am.
Is that against the law?
It is not.
The lady with the big hat said you were a dangerous radical. Are you?
Radical? Maybe. Dangerous only to men who fling cokes.
Is Mama communist?
No.
Am I?
Well, why don't we give you the official test? Mom makes your favorite lunch.
Ham and cheese.
Ham and cheese. And at school, you see someone with no lunch at all. What do you do?
Share.
Share? Well, you don't tell them to just go get a job?
No.
Oh, you offer them a loan at 6%. Oh, that's very clever.
Dad.
Ah, then you just ignore them.
No.
Well, well. You little commie.
This is one of those things where it's like, that's not a great... Like it could be a lot better, and it's mostly, it seems more tepid in the absence of other stuff to back it up.
Yeah.
But it is at the very least like what's at the heart of Trumbo's like whole deal. And it's like, well, he believes in redistributing wealth, basically.
Yeah. I
and
actually thought it was
like
good. Yeah. I thought in
nothing.
Some ways,
like,
no, yeah. I thought that was one of the better ones, actually. Like, I preferred that scene to some of the throwaway lines, you know, where they just give him some throwaway line to, you know, make reference to something, you know, that doesn't have any substance. It's just like, oh, he's referencing a socialist idea thing. You know, that was at least a tangible, conscious, thing of like, yeah, I think people should share. We should share the wealth. If you see someone that is that doesn't have lunch, you should share your lunch with them. That actually has some substance. And like, I would have preferred that there be more of that.
Yeah. And the film didn't want to, there could have been more.
Yeah. The film didn't want to, because the film was stuck between wanting to portray him as a socialist versus wanting to portray him as a liberal, honestly. And I just think the film didn't know how they wanted to.
I think it's actually the thing about the movie is I think it's just not that interested. I think it's more interested in something else.
Uh-huh.
And it is what the kind of second half of the movie is about. And it's this movie is sort of interesting because it's kind of two different movies, and the two movies are hinting at certain things and have good elements, but they never quite come together in a way that could make the movie like really good, like one of the better biopics. And so that this first half of the movie is kind of trying to be like a hard hitting, like this is the blacklist and this is the effects that people, you know, faced because of it. And, you know, he goes to jail and he's arguing with John Wayne. And I will say it is based how much this movie hates John Wayne. I did really like that about it.
They
just portrayed John Wayne as a total fucking idiot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally.
There's also the funniest part of the movie, in my opinion. Like, my favorite thing that happens is they're trying to hand out literature at the rally that John Wayne and Hedda Hopper are doing. And they're just like getting like totally cold shouldered by everyone. And then they get in the fight with John Wayne. And then afterwards, Louis C.K. just grabs the thing and tries to hand it to somebody and goes,
Would you like one, sir? We're communists.
And just like throws the thing in his hand, like just being extremely combative. And just like, this is not going well. And I thought that was very funny. But it's sort of this movie in the first half, and it kind of ditches it maybe halfway or three quarters of the way through when Arlen Herd dies and becomes this movie about really the way that Trumbo is ground down by having to work so fucking hard for way less money under these front writers, and the sort of ingenuity that he had to show to get his name back.
Yeah.
And that, in portraying that specific thing, it does a really good job. And I think it shows that is really what they were interested in with this, or what they really wanted to portray. And that's an interesting thing. And it's sort of in all of these things, like, I guess my defense of the movie, like my case for it really is like, you could do a lot worse than showing like a 15-year-old kid who's totally unfamiliar with the subject matter this movie as a potential entry point to like, oh, that was interesting, I'd like to learn more about this. And so, you know, it's got enough of these little touches or hints of something deeper that I was interested by it and engaged by it. And the you know, like, in terms of the consequences of the blacklist, the whole thing of him, I think the dynamic with his family, it works in some places and it really doesn't in others. But I did like that it could be more explicit about it or whatever, but it is portraying like this sense that because of this thing that happened to him, like, he becomes kind of an asshole and he's so horrifically overworked just to maintain like a very modest lifestyle in comparison to where he is at the beginning of the movie. And again, like, it's not fucking groundbreaking by any stretch of the imagination, but I did just kind of, there were things I could point to and say, that's good, that's true. Everything does at least redound to the thesis of like, this was really fucked up and it shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
It at least doesn't like really equivocate about it that much. It might equivocate about how much these guys were communists or what their sort of level of ideological commitment was, but at least it's not saying like, well, and the real reason this was bad is because they weren't communists. It's like, no, they were communists. They were communists. this was a fucked up thing. This shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You can tell it is kind of coming from the point of view of like, well, setting aside whatever they believed, it was still fucked up. But yeah. That's setting aside whatever they believed, it was still fucked up, is better than, well, it was really, it's fucked up because of all the people who kind of sort of suffered minor consequences for and were bitches about it.
Yeah.
And fucking name names and blah, blah, blah. And obviously there's the Edward G. Robinson thing, which we'll talk about. But it is, I will take it. That's always my whole thing with this entire movie is like, it's the closest thing I've ever gotten to like how a fucking MSNBC lib must have felt when they walked out of the theater when they saw the Post.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get a little bit of that as a treat.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what this felt like.
I get that. Yeah. I get that. I think again, you know, I feel for me, it's I'm more frustrated by some of those things. You know, I mean, there's a scene and I forget who it says it to who, but it's later in the film when they're reflecting on it. And someone says to Trumbo, like, come on, we weren't communists. We were babies. We were babies. We didn't know what we were doing. And I mean, I think unfortunately that is still baked into this is the idea that they were young, naive, didn't understand, you know, had a few meetings, did a few rallies and then got caught up. Which now to be fair, that's probably true of
to some extent
of the Hollywood 10. That's probably fairly true. That's probably fairly accurate of most of them. And so, you know, it leads me into, I think, again, if you're going to tell the story about the Red Scare, if you're going to do a Red Scare movie, you know, I really wish it would be about someone or some element of it where there was a bit more substance. I mean, you know, in telling the story of the Red Scare and having it be about the Hollywood 10, you are choosing as your subjects people like Dalton Trumbo, who I think realistically their commitment to socialism was pretty thin. And so I don't mind that they have characters point out the thinness of his socialism, but then as a movie, it becomes unsatisfying or as a political movie, as a movie that's trying to do something political, it becomes unsatisfying. I like what you pointed out about there being a significant part one, part two dynamic and part two, the part two dynamic is kind of like this hustle and grind, of these out of, you know, blacklisted writers trying to do the thing. And it's kind of funny. And some of the absolute best standout scenes in the movie are John Goodman and Stephen Root as like low budget schlock.
Particularly John Goodman.
Oh, he's so good. And in this fact, I actually grabbed an audio clip.
What I wanted to get to.
Yeah, and I'm going to play my favorite line in the
so
movie.
Good.
They steal this date. Like they steal every scene they're in. And the movie gets kind of fun. And in a sense, like, and so I enjoyed it in those at times, but I also was like, wait a second, like the point of this is that it sucked, not that it's kind of fun. And so again, I think this is where the film is just, the film is pulled in too many different directions. It's
That's reasonable.
It's trying to do Hollywood nostalgia about this kind of weird thing situation that these guys were in. And in a way it did a kind of a fun nostalgic thing about that. But it felt strange after the really heavy-handed first half and Arlen's dead and fucking Trumbo's yelling at his kids. But then, John Goodman is smashing people with a baseball bat in his office and it's fucking funny. Like it's just, it's a strange.
And this is, I think we have to, this is where I think we have to acknowledge. And this actually played a huge role in my like being nice to this movie. This movie is directed by Jay Roach, who is best known as the man behind Austin Powers.
Right.
And so like he is comedic in his instincts. He has not done another movie like this really to the best of my knowledge. Actually, that's not true. He's done a couple of like, I feel like he might have did like Game Change or like he's done a couple of HBO Bush era kind of, Bush Obama era political movies that are sort of whatever. But he's generally coming from a comedic point of view. And so like so much of that, like I'm colored by that a lot because I'm like, this is pretty fucking good for being directed by the Austin Powers guy. That's what I always come back to.
And that partly explains why, to be honest, some of the comic relief scenes worked better than I thought they would. It feels like a movie where the jokes are all going to fall flat. And yet there's like several scenes that surprised me by being legitimately funny, especially these John Goodman, Stephen Root bits, which I've got this thing ready. I can play this whenever you...
Yeah, please do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so the setup for this is that all of these blacklisted writers are writing, you know, taking shitty scripts and fixing them and making them good for John Goodman and Stephen Root, who, you know, run this like really shitty little production company. And so he's going through a bunch of these scripts with the different writers. Arlen Hurd is still alive at this point. He's one of them. And he has snuck into a movie that's supposed to be about a man with a bug head having sex, I think. But he snuck into it a bunch of socialist stuff.
Yeah, with like the farmer's daughter.
Yeah,
it's like
that's right.
The bug man and the farmer's daughter. I can't remember what it's actually called, but it's something like that.
So this is John Goodman railing against the communism that has been sort of snuck into this script.
You are the alien and the farm girl.
Yeah.
So you wrote the alien talking about the rights of the worker, the pathology of capitalism, the complacency of the bourgeoisie. I don't even know what it is, and I fucking hate it.
The idea was to
I paid you to write a script about a guy with a giant bug head stuffing a girl in a hayloft, and you write shit that's going to get me subpoenaed and stinks.
So, yeah, I mean,
that's so good.
Like, that's the stuff in here that was the most enjoyable. And yet it's also
it really is.
It's completely on a different tone from, you know, like it's like if you want to do a comedy about, you know, what it was like for these guys, do that. Maybe that would have been better in some ways.
Yeah, this movie might have actually been better if it was more like just a comedy, like still have all the stuff in there about, you know, like you could keep the scene that we met, both liked, the one that I mentioned with his daughter, and you could keep like some of the political stuff, but then just like sort of ditch like the family angle and just really make it like a comedy about them trying to like do this thing. And it might have actually made the sort of lack of political sophistication easier to swallow and like made for a more fun, better movie.
Yeah.
I also, on the same note, there is a scene where John Goodman is like threatened by, I can't remember who it is specifically, if it's supposed to be like Ray Cohn or somebody. Like somebody basically figures out that he's hiring these blacklisted writers. He's sort of subtly threatening John Goodman, and John Goodman just springs up with a baseball bat. I'll pipe in the audio of what he says because it's so funny.
Fire Dalton Trumbo and the rest of them. Or you got pickets, headlines, and boycotts. We will put you right out of business.
We?
The Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. Me and Ronald Reagan, Hedda Hopper, Guild Studio Heads, John Wayne.
Love John Wayne.
Well, I'll introduce you. You guys could do a movie together.
Oh, gee, that'd be swell. Except... I don't think you and me are going to be pals.
Frank!
You want to keep me from hiring union?
I'll go downtown, hire a bunch of winos and hookers. It doesn't matter. I make garbage.
Frank!
You want to call me a pinko in the papers? Do it. None of the people that go to my fucking movies can read.
Frank!
I'm in this for the money and the pussy, and they're both falling off the trees. Take it away from me. Go ahead, I won't sue you, but this will be the last fucking thing you see before I beat you to death with it. Tiffany!
Right here.
I actually even though it's, like you said, like totally just has totally a different tone and totally like a completely different thing, I did kind of like the observation that it's making there about how like there's this company that's a few degrees below the big Hollywood studios in sophistication, and for them they are just like, well, fuck, I don't care, be communist, fucking be from Pluto, I don't give a shit, we need to make these movies, I'll hire whoever can fucking, you know, fix my shitty scripts and send them in on time. And I don't, like, why would I give a shit? Like, I'm just trying to make these movies or whatever. And that is, like, That is true to life, and it's interesting because it is kind of inadvertently making this point about how, like, there's a level of wealth that you get to where you can afford to have these kind of ideological commitments, but for a sort of more like petty bourgeois movie studio, they're just like, look, man, if you can write me a movie that gives me an excuse to use this gorilla suit I just bought, I don't care if you're like literally selling information about me to the KGB. It doesn't matter. Yeah. We're making movies here.
And
all of that stuff really like sung for me in a way that made me kind of just be like, all right, I'm down for this. I like this.
Yeah.
And I think so. The other element that we have to touch on, because we've been dancing around it this entire time, is Louis C.K. and the Arlen Heard thing. And I do think this is really going to be probably what explains explains the difference between the two of us. And I'm going to hazard a guess, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm going to hazard a guess that you probably never cared for Louis C.K. in the first place.
No, I liked him.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
So that actually makes this conversation quicker and easier in a sense, because I imagine then that our read on Louis C.K. is going to be more or less the same, which is that at the time when he was coming up doing his show, Louis, and doing stand up and all of that, like, my read on Louis C.K. was that he was a pretty funny stand up comedian, that his show was pretty funny and interesting and good. And then all this shitty stuff came out about him, and I felt kind of nauseous about it.
Yeah.
Because it was like the whole Louis C.K. thing, his whole deal was kind of predicated on, this is a guy who is trying to be a decent guy, kind of stupid, but kind of like his heart's in the right place. And he's trying to manage all of these things that are relatable, that make him also kind of a shitty guy.
Yeah.
And but a big part of that is that, you know, it's okay to, you know, it's okay for me to come out and make jokes about this stuff, and to appeal to the part of you that fucking hates your kids' friends because they're terrible, awful children or whatever. But because it doesn't come out in my life, it's okay, because it's all just stuff that you think about.
Yeah, exactly.
But then when you find out that it in fact does come out in his life, it reframes the entire thing and makes it shitty. And
totally.
And like, he is a guy who, more so than almost anyone else I can think of, is impossible to separate the art from the artist.
Like, exactly.
It literally made it so that stuff he had made is unwatchable to me now because it's so disgusting. And so where I think we differ as it relates to this movie is that, because he's not playing himself, and he's playing this guy, Arlen Heard, who is a guy who is like, I am sympathetic to for a number of different reasons. I saw the movie when it came out at the time, and this stuff wasn't out yet. And I remember thinking he was pretty funny and pretty good in it. And now watching it again, knowing what's up with him, it does bother me, because just seeing him at all bothers me. But watching it, I was like, okay, I know why this trick worked on me, and it's because it's a good trick.
Oh, it was a really good trick. I agree with you completely. I feel the exact same way. For me, the Louis C.K. thing was such a specific type of I'm not gonna say betrayal, because I didn't know the dude, I wasn't personally
betrayed. It does kind of feel like
it has that feeling, because his whole performance was of a profoundly honest dude. That was his whole shtick, was like, I'm gonna be honest with you. Here's the dark corners of me, and here they are, and like, we can laugh at them. And yet I'm aware that I live in a society. This is me being Louis. He would say these things, right?
Sure,
like, here's the shitty parts of me, but I'm in a society, and I got to learn how to be in that society. And you know what? There's women in this society too, and men treat women like shit. So I'm a man. I'm going to have to figure out how to not treat women like shit. And all of it did this thing of like, yeah, he's a flawed dude, but he is very concretely working through like what it is to be a dude in the 21st century. And mm-hmm. for that to turn out to be fucking bullshit when his whole shtick was, you know, this is just me, here I am. Yeah, it just made me fucking loathe the sight of him. And it also, yeah,
that's totally reasonable.
Right. And then also in addition to that, it's what he has done since then, which is just the most unbecoming, like cringe.
It's embarrassing.
Embarrassing, humiliating, secondhand embarrassment at watching him do bad comedy about being canceled. Nothing that he does is even remotely funny anymore because he unraveled the source and the core of what was funny and relatable
about
him.
The Emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's like, for me, he's just, you know, it's not conscious. It's not like I'm making a, you know, it's not like I sit at home saying like, oh, as a political stand, I'm going to not like Louis C.K. It's not like that.
No.
I just see the guy's face and I'm repulsed. And so, yeah, it really colored. And in his portrayal of Arlen Heard, the character, I really felt like he just acted like Louis. Like I really, and
yeah, he does.
Right. And he just kind of seemed like a slightly more historicized version of the exact guy that he played when he performed as himself in the show. So yeah, that really was tough. That's not the film's fault. Like, I don't blame the film for that. And I don't hold that against the film. It made some of those scenes harder for me to enjoy. But yeah, I don't hold that against, you know, like,
yeah,
the
director. I think for me, the thing that made it easier for me to just like compartmentalize it and enjoy it is that I was able to kind of like, because they're not his words, or because it's like, he's not him, like explicitly, like it, like you might say he's just playing this guy as if he was him. And I would agree with that. But like, because he is this, you know, invented like historical figure or whatever, it made it easier to just be like, well, that's just a funny line read or whatever. And not like, oh, well, it's funny because of that sort of complicated thing that you just laid out there a second ago. It's just literally like, well, he's very good at delivering that line of just being like, we're communists here, take this thing or whatever. And so it didn't, like, it bothered me, I think, a lot less than it would in almost any other context. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to get a little long here. So I think the last thing we should cover is just the ending and the Edward G. Robinson thing, because I for sure that was the thing that riled me the most, that most left a bad taste in my mouth, and I imagine that may be the case for you as well. And
yeah,
so
it was annoying.
So the whole thing with Edward G. Robinson that is true is that he was a, I mean, it is sad in a way, because he was a I guess what would be described as like a communist sympathizer, and generally more of just like a left liberal guy who had a lot of professional relationships with communists, probably attended some meetings, and initially was like a kind of a powerful ally to a lot of these guys, because he helped pay for their legal fees initially, and was like, you know, at least in the movie, you know, they portray he is like selling his paintings and, you know, like putting up some money to help these guys. And but that only lasts for a short while before he just rolled over like a dog on all of these guys and, you know, put all their names out there. And he says later in the movie that he didn't give up anybody whose names they didn't already have. And you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. Mm-hmm. I believe that. But it doesn't matter because you still did it. Yeah. And you know, it's the same fucking, it's the Whitey Bulger argument, right?
Yeah,
it's just like, it's total mafia logic.
Yeah.
And there's a scene that's actually a good scene, I thought, where he gets kind of dressed down by Trumbo, because Trumbo goes to his house and gives him the money back.
Yeah.
And he says like, we don't want this on our books anymore.
Yeah.
It's one of the better moments of the movie where Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays Edward G. Robinson, which is a choice, I don't know how I felt about it. Mm-hmm. But this is one scene where that is good, where he says, you don't understand. I didn't work for a year. And it is like, I think, meant to land with a thud, because, of course, we've just watched Trumbo serve 11 months in literal prison.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's such a like it's very pathetic.
Yeah.
And if they had just, I swear to God, like if they had literally not changed anything except just not cutting to him in the final scene.
Yeah.
And it would, I feel like it wouldn't have bothered me, but yeah. It's just like, he gives a speech at the end when he's finally reinstated and he's won the Oscar for Spartacus, which is another moment, by the way, where they kind of hint at his ideology a little bit, because they're like, you'd like this movie. It's about a slave uprising yeah. or whatever, which is like, that's a nice little, touch in there or whatever. And, sure. He's at the WGA, I believe, like awards or something. And he gives this speech about the whole thing. And I can't remember the content of it exactly, but it's too conciliatory. It's very much like, well, we were all victims in this. And, you know, I guess if I really wanted to be generous, I would say that it's just portraying Trumbo as being the bigger man, because, you know, Edward G. Robinson does not come across good, and they do not reconcile. They just show him in the audience listening to this.
Yeah.
But it is not clear enough in its purpose to dissuade you from thinking that it is not just like, oh, it was actually fine that he did that. Yeah. And so that's a problem for me.
Yeah,
for sure.
Me too. It's one of the many sort of just like moments of weakness. This is a film that's very weak, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a film that's trying to be brave, but that is actually pretty weak. And it shows signs of how it could be really brave, but then routinely, I think, just kind of slips into some sort of cowardice. And that's definitely one of the moments. The other one for me that I actually found to be maybe worse was the scene where when Trumbo's in jail, they brush through it pretty quickly. But there's one sort of relationship that he forms when he's in prison with a black guy. And I don't know the actor. I only remember that he was in Oz. He played Simon from Oz. But anyways, that guy runs like the supply room in prison. And Trumbo kind of comes along to sort of see if he can work in the supply room. And it's a really good scene in terms of the acting and the subtext. You know, Trumbo, played very well by Bryan Cranston in this case, is kind of, you know, politely inquiring about jobs in the supply room and whether he could help and give a helping hand. You know, well, I used to be a writer kind of thing. And there's this very, very subtle arrogance to it. The assumption that this black guy doesn't know how to run a supply room, doesn't know how to maintain the books and whatever, which he picks up on immediately, says like, I fucking know who you are. You're the fucking writer. You're the fucking communist. Like, don't fucking talk down to me. I murdered a white guy and I'll do it again kind of thing.
He says he murdered him for robbing his bar.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Which I thought was interesting, because the real shame in all of this is just like, it would have been nice to just have another black character, really. Like, that's my biggest issue all of this.
Yeah,
just
of
like,
course.
It's just kind of a problem that there's one black guy in the movie and he's like a black Republican.
That's
basically,
it.
Or what we
he's
would
a
consider
reactionary.
To be like a black Republican now.
Yeah. And
it is funny, and it works. It's just, again, it's another example of many things in this movie that are fine in a vacuum, but when taken all together, you're just left feeling like, what was this trying to say?
Well, that's just it. It's not situated properly. There's nothing wrong with, and I'm all for trying to maybe portray and talk about, like, what is the relationship between, you know, someone who is fairly privileged, this white writer from Hollywood, who is a socialist, and someone who potentially is like from the most, like the hardcore of the working class, the most oppressed caste in North America, who is not a communist and who hates communists and think they're bad, right?
Is also a small business owner.
Oh, well, exactly, is the petty bourgeois.
Which makes it interesting.
So,
like,
right, that could be.
Again, it's one of those things where it's like, well, I like that he's a small business owner. Like, that's smart putting that in there. as opposed to just a guy who, like, if he wasn't a small business owner, then I would feel more like I could point to that and just being like, that's trying to say that socialism is for white people and they don't understand the real salt of the earth black people who are all actually secretly reactionaries.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's trying to do that. But again, it's just not clear enough to make me sure that that's not what it's
trying. It's not clear enough. That's the problem with it. And I think I said to you, this is the one that made me say, I would love this if it was a Ken Loach film, because if the whole film was taking on all of these things and if there were black Republicans, but also black socialists, like there were many of them, we don't meet any of them in the film, but there were lots of black socialists. You know, if all of these different people are in the mix, then you can have these dynamics. You can let them play out, even the uncomfortable ones, and they can be really interesting. True Detective, the third True Detective, did a great job of having, you know, a white liberal and a black Republican that's set at different times, but it's set, much of it is set in segregation era. They do that and they do it well. It's important. It's like, you can't just go the easy road on a lot of these things. So I like it, but the film didn't do it well enough. It did this half-assed version of it. And so I honestly did come away from that scene with the sense of like, oh yeah, this is just to remind us that, you know, communists are silver spoon elitists, you know, and the real people hate them. And you're right. They do mention that the guy is a small business owner, but it's dropped in. It's not established very well. And so you're given this sense
of
like,
no, it's not like, it's not foregrounded. For
exactly.
Sure.
And you just come away with the sense that Trumbo represents these rich guys who dabble in socialism. And it's not, they exist, and it's fine to criticize them, or at least like put them in their place, whatever. But in the absence of like a broader sense of what the socialist world was and looked like and who was in it and what they all thought and did, you end up with a pretty thin and not necessarily very sympathetic portrayal of the socialists that did exist in America. So it's little things like that where I just think the film tries to do too much, doesn't always manage to do any of the things right because it's kind of contradicting itself. And I mean, yeah, it's not the worst 2 hours I've ever spent. You could wheel it into a classroom and a group of grade 10 students would come away with, like, you know, a reasonably balanced portrayal of that situation. But at the same time, man, I so rarely get to see Hollywood movies that involve openly communist characters who talk about communism. I wish they could have done a better job of it, you know?
Yeah, that's a reasonable note to end on. I think what I will say, you said you give it like a C, so like what, like a 3 out of 5?
Yeah, it's a 3. I'd give it a 3. Yeah.
And
2.5
I would
to
say
3.
That is what it should give, but I'll give it a B based on grading on a curve. So we're grading on a curve.
Bell curve.
And because of that, because this is the best of a group of bad movies, I'll give it a B when, you know, arguably on a curve, it could get an A just by being the best of a bad group of movies. But I'll be honest with myself and give it a B. And what I'll close on is that my dream for like the future of film and also of the world is that this movie, when, you know, 100 years from now in like a film studies class, is seen as an interesting failure, but an interesting moment in opening up movies starting to be about socialism again after several years of not being, because I think you can kind of take this movie as like, it's a sort of early attempt at something like Judas and the Black Messiah, where there are some problems, but there are significantly less problems and significantly more explicit in like the Black Panthers were socialists, they were the good guys, et cetera, et cetera. And then my hope is that 10 years from that moment, there will be you know, we'll be able to point to something even better than that.
Yeah.
And that, of course, 10 years from that moment, it'll be, and this is of course the moment when all, when filmmaking changed forever because of the Glorious Workers Revolution that happened. I liked it. The things about it that were bad just didn't bother me that much.
Yeah. You know what would be interesting on that note? I would be interested to know what someone like Boots Riley thinks of the movie Trumbo, right?
Yeah,
what totally. Is it like to be a socialist filmmaker now, writing socialist movies now, explicitly socialist movies now, reflecting on what happened at that, you know, in the 40s and 50s, and then, you know, that movie's portrayal of it? Like, I suspect he'd probably share a lot of the same sort of frustrations that we have, right? But I mean, yeah, that'd be an interesting...
It would be interesting. I would love to hear his take on the Black Republican guy.
Yeah.
I feel like you could get a really interesting, like, interesting thoughts from him on that.
Yeah, yeah.
This was a fun one. You'll be hearing again from us soon. We have a couple of ideas for sort of mini series, some related movies. I want to do one on Westerns, and then we have another idea in the can as well, so we'll have to talk at some point about which one of those we want to pursue first. But thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.